Hi, I'm Philip Shepherd. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this amazing once-in-a-lifetime conference, and especially to the Meditation and Breathwork channel, which I'm proud to be sponsoring because meditation and breathwork are essential to my teachings. I'm the founder of the Embodied Present Process, or TEP, which is based on my two books and is taught worldwide. And here's one thing I believe about meditation and breathwork. You limit your experience of both if you imagine that your mind is just the thoughts in your head. Your mind permeates your every cell. Every stirring of energy within your body is an expression of it. So, if you wish to calm your mind, the most direct route is to develop the skills that enable you to feel the body's energy and ground it in the spaciousness of the present. That's what my work is about. If that appeals to you, I hope you'll check out my two presentations, one on this channel and one on the main stage. You might also be interested in a special offer exclusive to the Embodiment Conference to listen to one of my embodied meditations for yourself for free. You can find a link to the special offer in the description of this presentation or on the show notes. And now, enjoy the presentation.
So now back to Martin. So let me quickly introduce Martin to you who are new to his teaching. So he is a Buddhist meditation teacher, a co-founder of Mindfulness Training Institute UK. He has been practicing meditation intensively for 30 years now, and he has been teaching Dharma and guiding people in their practice since 1999. He created Work, Sex, Money, Dharma in 2011, running courses to support people in integrating transformational practices and meditative insight into their daily lives. He has also founded the Sangha Live platform, which is the world's biggest online Dharma practice group open for anyone to join. Martin, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and passion with us today. The stage is all yours now.
Nice. Well, thank you, Aggie. And just as well as thanking you, just to extend some thanks to all the team and the many of you working hard over not just these weeks that the conference has been on, but over months and months. And I've been in touch with Mark several times at various drama points in the prep. And so I'm just aware that a lot of you have put a lot of care and time and energy and all into making this happen. So great. And we're all, in a way, we're all the beneficiaries of that. So thank you. And then welcome, everyone. I'll mention it's just started raining here, and maybe you can hear the rain on my tin roof. Somebody suggested we might find a technical fix for the background noise, but I don't know any technical fix to change the weather. So maybe we can just enjoy the fact that the first months that I spent in long meditation retreat in Thailand in 1990 was during the monsoon season. And so the kind of first real deep dive I did into meditation practice was very often accompanied by the sound of rain on roofs. So for me, it's very evocative, sound of a rain. It feels more like a blessing than a background noise. So maybe you can include it a little in that way. All right, so it's somewhat appropriate, given that the conference is dying today. You know, it's the last day of this long and full series of extraordinary presentations and explorations together. So it's somewhat appropriate that this is the moment we get to spend a little time contemplating death. And you know, it's interesting, just in the time leading up to going live, when just a few people were here, and I said, oh, that, just that. Oh, so the conference is dying. And I could just see a few sort of facial reactions on the screen that, you know, that which express what we often notice or feel ourselves or see in others when we bring forth the subject of death, you know, which is, you know, a mixture of some alarm, some discomfort, some denial, maybe. And the very fact that we have some kind of resistant reaction or uncomfortable reaction to that is interesting, given that it's just a simple truth, right? Everything dies. And rather than just everything, most essentially, we we're all dying. We're all going to die soon. You're going to die soon. Right? Soon means what? Maybe in some decades, maybe in some days, maybe in some moments. I mean, really, we don't know. And when we lose somebody to, particularly to an accident or injury, some kind of sudden death, we get maybe momentarily woken up to both to the fragileness, the fragility of our own lives. So that's just a simple truth. There's no arguing with it. We're all going to die. And, you know, in the great scheme of things, pretty soon. Right? Even in the best case scenario, you're probably, depending on your age, at least 30% of the way through. Maybe some of us more like 50%, 70%. So part of exploring this theme is to recognize, what do we do? What kind of, you know, very much bodily reaction do we have to really, not just vaguely acknowledging the idea, but really, really taking in the truth that soon we're going to die? And then another way of expressing that is, you're going to lose everyone and everything you care about, or they'll lose you. One way or the other is inevitable. Either you'll lose everyone as they die, or they'll lose you when you die. So that kind of loss and death is an absolutely inevitable part of the fabric of life. And yet when we lean in that direction, we might start to think, well, why would I want to focus on that? You know, what kind of depressive, morbid, miserable guy is this that wants to put the accent and the emphasis on that? And it may be that at the first layer, and we'll look at this in all kinds of different ways as we go through, it may be that the first layer of acknowledging death, contemplating death, is one where of discomfort, fear, resistance, etc. But what we'll also see is, as we go through that first layer, where we're confronted by the fragility of our lives, oh, I'm going to die, and everyone's going to die, and I'm going to lose everyone I love, or they're going to lose me. The next part, because our lives are fragile and fleeting, contemplating death is also the way we get to really wake up in a particular kind of way to the fact that, because our lives are fragile, they're also immensely precious, not to be taken for granted. Right? The fact that I'm going to die soon actually brings me back to the fact that in this moment, I'm not dead. You know, in this moment, just the miracle of the basic aliveness of body. Here is a functioning nervous system, functioning sensory apparatus, functioning cognition, a functioning emotional life. And how easily we get so used to seeing and hearing and thinking and feeling that we just take it for granted. Oh yeah, I'll go along, I'm a thinking, feeling being. You know? So contemplating death is one way in which we wake up to the miracle and the ungraspable miracle. We can't really make sense ever. We cannot really make sense of what this is. This capacity we find ourselves with to think, feel, sense, know, explore, conceive, feel. But we can, and that's what embodiment's all about in many ways, we can learn to increasingly inhabit this thinking, feeling, moving life with greater and greater awareness, with greater and greater clarity, with greater and greater ease, and with greater and greater fearlessness. Because when we start to, our relationship to death, which is often an unacknowledged one, is very much a relationship with fear. And most of the fears that we encounter, if we follow them, we can find the kind of the protective mechanisms that are very much about a fear of death. So that's part of the explanation, uncovering and meeting and reconciling ourselves with our dying nature, if you like. And then the other part of it, which may seem somewhat paradoxical, is really the way that process can bring us into the natural cherishing of life. It seems like either we cherish life or we embrace death. They sound paradoxical, but actually they end up being the same thing. The more we really acknowledge and make peace with and are really okay about our dying nature, the more, in fact, we might feel, you know, actually, if death is what happens in the next moment, I'm okay, I'm ready to die. The more we feel ready to die, ironically, the more we find we're able to really cherish and make use of and be in the miracle of our life. I've been kind of contemplating death, particularly within the practices of the Buddhist tradition, but also in general for a long time, 35 years probably. But I got a particular taste actually this year. I got COVID in March, and I didn't have it very, very severely. I didn't have to be hospitalized, but I did get it. It was very long. I was 2 months completely bedbound, like 23 hours a day in bed, very, very, very weak. A lot of oppression in the lungs, difficult to breathe. And at times it really felt like my lungs were just kind of shutting, that my organs were just shutting down in various ways. And at the same time, it was springtime. And I live out in the countryside in southwest France, and I'm looking out through my bedroom window at the trees and the kind of effulgence of the springtime. And, you know, there were times when I thought, you know, this might be it. The news was full of people dying of this thing. And, you know, it was interesting to both feel like, okay, well, if death is what comes for me, I want to die freely, graciously, you know. And feeling really okay about that. Not wanting to die, of course not. But feeling on the one hand, if death is what comes, let me meet it graciously. And on the other hand, in the same orientation, just feeling how much there's a natural cherishing of life. Like, oh, I love life. What a blessing it is to be able to see trees, to be able to, you know, speak, feel, think, etc. So it's kind of counterintuitive that we find a deep love of life and a deep acceptance of death actually in the same contemplative territory. So it's like, and on the way we pass through, basically, when we start to contemplate death, we pass through what we're afraid of. We also pass through what we're identified with. And we start to contemplate, oh, dying. I'm dying soon. And we'll do some meditation in a moment that gives us a way of contemplating that. We pass through the territory of where we're identified with this body, where we're identified with, how we're identified with time, how we're identified in various relationships. And to free up our relationship with death then, oh, maybe that can free up in unimaginable ways, actually, how much care we give to relationships when we don't take them for granted because we don't know how long they're going to last. How much care we give to the miracle of this body because we don't take it for granted. We don't know how long it'll last. It's kind of interesting that we're living through this pandemic situation, which is very much, or certainly an invitation to be a kind of large-scale death reflection. And it's also interesting to see how strong some of the views are, the views about wearing masks or not, the views about lockdowns or not, the views about how real coronavirus is or not. And aside from the trying to pass out what's true in those views, what's interesting is to see how much emotionality is animated in the different views, which is basically the incapacity to accept the uncertainty of things. You know? Incapacity to realize, oh, I'm afraid here, I'm afraid of dying, and how much strong views emerge as some kind of pushback against that. So, death, the great leveler. You know, when people die, we often have a sense, you know, of tragedy. Certainly, if we lose someone we love, there's grief. Grief is love in response to absence. But it's not wrong that someone dies. It's not actually a tragedy that someone dies. We might, if we're the ones left behind, we might experience a feeling of tragedy or of and of loss, and maybe of unfairness, and maybe of regret, maybe of guilt, all kinds of subsidiary feelings. But actually the fact that people die, the fact that we die, is not wrong. It's the most natural thing. It's the only and complete natural conclusion to anything that takes birth, is that it dies. And we might accept that when somebody dies, you know, peacefully in their 90s, after a long and full life, etc. It's a lot harder sometimes to accept that it's equally true that it's natural to die when somebody dies in their 20s or 30s or 40s, or actually at any age. That's also natural. The sense of tragedy might feel greater and more acute and stronger for those who are left behind. But if someone dies in their youth or their middle age, if we end up dying in your youth or middle age, that's not wrong either. We don't arrive with some kind of guarantee certificate of X number of decades. You know. So of course that might be a harder truth to take in. It certainly might be a hard truth to take in if you have a loved one who's with a terminal illness, or you have a loved one that has died recently, maybe at a young age. But the fact is, it is as normal, we could say, it's as natural to die from illness or injury or accident as it is to die of just gradually wearing out over many decades. It's as natural to die from illness or accident or injury as it is to die of so-called old age. And I say that, you know, so a little tentatively, because I know that can be hard to hear if the grief of losing a loved one is still alive in you. So part of coming to terms with the naturalness of death, our own and others, is a kind of metabolizing in our nervous system of the way of the unresolved threads and knots of grief, hurt, blame, guilt, anger. These are some of the emotional residues that stay around when it's too much for us, when we don't have the resources to actually digest death, when we don't have the resources to just to recognize, oh, these difficult feelings, painful feelings here are actually, oh, they're love filtered through fear or anger or blame. But you know, if we miss someone because they die, if we're angry that someone's died, if we're sad that someone's died, why? Because of love. And that's actually often the way into some of that real digestion around grief and guilt and these other emotional nuances, is recognizing that they spring from love and allowing the sadness. It's the way to be most respectful to the memory of a loved one, is by actually letting oneself go through the layers of emotional residue that are there following someone's death. So, we'll see how much room as we get to the end, as we get a little further through the hour, we'll see how much room we might have for both grief, the whole bunch of kind of inner work one can do around understanding and working with grief, and also some of the resources one can bring to being with somebody as they're dying. But at first I want to just us to give the some attention to how we can actually, in a in terms of an embodiment practice, actually meet and get familiar with the reality of our own dying nature. So let's just do a short meditation where we'll use the rhythm of breathing to contemplate, not so much in a cognitive sense, but in a very embodied felt sense. Right? Every out-breath is not exactly a death, but it's an invitation, if we let it be one. Each out-breath is an invitation to let ourselves become familiar with a sense of ending. If you have a regular meditation practice, you might notice the way that the in-breath is inherently energizing, expansive, and the out-breath is inherently pacifying, relaxing. Thought tends to take birth on the in-breath, and the out-breath is somewhere where one can just, you can sort of invite everything to soften, drop. You can use every out-breath, in other words, in a meditative sense, as a rehearsal for dying. As a kind of way of getting familiar with letting go. Letting go muscularly, you know, in the out-breath as a natural relaxation. Letting go energetically of the attempt to control and manage your experience. Letting go cognitively of the thread of thought that you might have started to build on and run off in the in-breath. So, I'll give a little guidance. Why don't you sit in a way that's comfortable, but that also expresses a certain kind of dignity and alignment and uprightness. Helpful to just roll your shoulders back a little, open your chest so your breath can move freely. Good to let your belly, as much as possible, just be soft. Round and relaxed. Why don't you take one or two very full breaths to start, just a big in-breath that really expands, it starts down in your belly, and then a real sigh of an out-breath, and then just let your breathing rhythm be very natural, however it is. And gather your attention inside the feel of breathing. With the expansive feel of the in-breath. The relaxing feel of the out-breath. The momentary still point between breaths. And just for a few moments, really settling into this felt sense, this intimacy with breathing body. and notice the expansiveness, the energizing quality of the in-breath. And then notice the relaxing quality, the dissolving quality of each out-breath. And as each out-breath comes round, seeing if you can really give yourself to that dissolving quality. Letting your muscles soften into the out-breath. Particularly the facial muscles, where you often hold a little tension around your eyes or in your jaw. And then seeing if you can let your ideation, the ideas and images, habitual thinking, seeing if all that can just gently dissolve into the out-breath. And seeing if you can just feel for the stillness at the end of each out-breath. And the stillness, which we both long for and yet resist. The stillness we so easily fill with thinking, with doing. And using these few moments of meditation to just to experiment in each out-breath with dissolving into stillness. And if you find that taste of stillness, of goneness, the stillness after thought, the stillness of that dissolution, then just letting yourself, really letting the whole of you rest momentarily into that. And if you don't, if what you find is some agitation or resistance, or the compulsion to fill that space with thought, then just be interested in that. Letting yourself be familiar with the habit of doing, of thinking, of resisting silence and stillness. And in these last moments, just listening with your whole attention to the way the cycles of breath can teach you about life and death. Energizing in-breath, dissolving out-breath, stillness between breaths. May we all cultivate the art of living fully and dying freely. So, that feels like something of a micro meditation, but you know, if you're not familiar with a way to, you know, bypass just the thinking about life and death, as it were, my life and my death, etc., and as a way to actually cultivate a different channel, and you know, very embodied, kind of alive, non-conceptual way of sort of informing yourself, informing your understanding, but also informing your nervous system about how to live, you know, with that dynamism and expansion. That's the invitation of in-breath, and how to die, with the allowing of and the relaxing into and the dissolution of every out-breath. Then that, you know, I offer that little taste of meditation as a way to orientate to that. There's a few other ways. Maybe one we could do briefly now, and then I'll make a little time for questions you might have before we go on. So there's one other exercise we can do together. And maybe before we do that exercise, I'll just speak about some other kind of ways to orientate to this in everyday life. Because really from the different contemplative traditions, the message about death contemplation is don't wait. Right? Don't wait. The tense is, oh, death, maybe I'll just deal with that when the moment comes. I'll deal with that at the moment of dying. But you know, dying, I don't know what dying's like, but it must be pretty, you know, it's a pretty fundamental life event, right? And if you're interested in the miracle of being alive, the miracle of being human, if you're interested in the mysteriousness of consciousness, then, you know, death is going to be some kind of pretty profound change in how consciousness is, right? And without getting into a lot of beliefs and speculation about death, one of the big things about consciousness right now is it's pretty clearly located, right, in this body and mind, in this location. And that seems like it's going to change at the moment of death, because this body then is just becoming some kind of rotting lump of flesh. And if you've ever sat with a dead body, it's very, very tangible in a way that, you know, becomes obvious, even though we can't understand it. That this goes from being, you know, a living soul, you know, this body as being something animated by consciousness, to a lump of rotting flesh. So if you're interested in the way consciousness can and does shift and transform and deepen over life, and you recognize that death must be a pretty significant moment for that, then, yeah, the message from the traditions is don't wait. It's like if you were a musician, you wouldn't wait till the moment of a big concert to try to play your instrument well, right? You'd do some practice. The idea that at the moment of death, when, you know, there may be, which may be accompanied by fear or pain or, you know, all kind of, who knows what will be going on in situationally at the moment of death. But the idea that at that moment you'll have the good resources with no preparation or practice to skillfully navigate death, well, that's kind of wishful thinking. So this meditation is one of the ways. Oh, we just kind of do some of it. We lay the groundwork for being able to die freely, which simultaneously becomes part of the groundwork for living fully. Some other ways of doing that are in resting, right? To make a little time each day when you rest. It may be after lunch if you have the opportunity to lie down a little. I'm always encouraging people to take a nap after lunch, but you know, people have lives that may not, you know, if you're working in an office, you can't necessarily just lie down on or under your desk for 20 minutes. But because of COVID, so many people are not anymore at their desks that now I can encourage people much more easily to, because everybody's at home all day, or many people are. So it's like rest, a little nap after lunch is very, very good for the nervous system. But often what happens, and the reason it's good for the nervous system, is because we get to kind of arrest the momentum of the day, the ego momentum of doing, becoming, getting, having, making, and then just to stop that a little bit and feel the kind of the build-up of momentum, and you get to just actually learn how to not exactly switch it off, but let it subside. So it sounds good. Oh, have a little nap, have a little rest after lunch. But often it's quite a difficult practice for people to learn the art of resting, right? So it sounds good. Oh, you just go as if you're just going to luxuriate. But actually when people lie down, often it's like, Okay, well, here I am. How long do I have to stay here for? What's the time? You know, what's next? So to actually let yourself become familiar with the activation of everyday nervous system, and to be able to just to stay with it, care for it, give it some space, but stop feeding it, so that it actually subsides and you get to taste every day in resting that sense of just of a conscious transition from active mode to quiet mode, still mode, relaxed mode. The art to invest a little in the art of conscious relaxation. There's a lot of benefits to that. One, it gives us that taste of, as I say, of just the transition into stillness without kind of a nervous energy. And also, it's just kind of good for the health, it's good for the sleep rhythm, it's good for just general the regulation of the nervous system. So it's an opportunity not just to rest, but it's an opportunity to get familiar with and comfortable with and accommodating of non-rest, you know, and to just to persist a little through that. And then you start to find that, oh, even when I'm agitated, I can hang out with it and I can just let it sort of run itself out. Very helpful. Another way of contemplating death in everyday life is just to give attention to endings. Like any kind of endings. The ending of a meal. You just look at your plate. You know, you had this lovely meal and it was all colourful and steaming on the plate and looking delicious. And then you look at it at the end and it's just sort of a messy smear of stuff on the plate. And you just acknowledge, oh yeah, that's what happens. And then, you know, you put some flowers in the jar and they're lovely. And then they wilt. Oh yeah, that's what happens. You just get, you kind of give yourself opportunities to be in the atmosphere of the natural rhythm of living and dying. You know? The ending of activities. So when some activity comes to an end, just acknowledging, oh yeah, that's what happens. And whether it's the three examples I just gave or countless others, right, meals, flowers, activities, you get to not just acknowledge that natural rhythm, but you get to see your habits. So for some of us, the habit when something ends is, just to move on to the next thing. You know, the kind of habit of, you know, generating, doing, moving, pursuing, grabbing. Well, for some of us, the more common habit is a sense of, just even in a very minor way, a sense of bereftness or loss, as if somehow life has taken something away from me. Life's taken that meal away or those flowers away or that activity away, and we can find ourselves kind of wanting to hold on. Same in relationships, you know, to give attention to partings. And some people, the way they say goodbye, like even on the phone, you know, they say, okay, bye then, yeah, bye, bye, nice to see you, bye, talk to you soon, okay, bye, yeah, bye. And it's like they say goodbye 20 times, because there's some way in which the parting, just the natural ending of the connection or the conversation is unconsciously reminding them of endings. So you get it, getting it, that's another place where you can just kind of contemplate the naturalness and you come to the end. Take care. Bye. And you just let yourself abide for a moment in the moment of absence, like that still moment that follows the out-breath. And it's interesting that still moment is often very, 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 almost imperceptibly brief, right, at first. But when your nervous system relaxes, when you get more familiar with just allowing breath to find and follow its own rhythm, the pause at the end of the out-breath can start to become very, very long. 10 seconds, 20 seconds, 30 seconds. And more significant than how long in seconds it is, it can start to feel timeless. Like you just breathe out and then And then consciousness kind of gets vast and dark and still, kind of like the night sky. That kind of infinite darkness, infinite vastness, infinite mysteriousness, infinite stillness. And so attending to endings is another way of just feeling into that kind of deep possibility. And the moment after you put the phone down, you might stay current, might be really enjoying the conversation. Wonderful. And to abide in a moment of loving that person or whatever. Another way to attend to that in partings is recognizing, you know, when you say goodbye to a loved one, you don't know if you're going to ever see them again. And it's not that you need to labor that. It's not like you need to kind of, you know, get everything off your chest every time you pop out to the shops. But it is a good reminder to not let unresolved emotional material linger. Right? To not, you know, the biggest, the most pain people experience when around death is when they feel like they it's too late to resolve what was left unfinished between them. And so just that thought, when you go out or you go away, you go out briefly for half an hour, or you go away for the weekend or something, just that you kind of, even if it's inwardly, it may not be a relationship where it's particularly appropriate. Like with my parents, if I start telling them, hey, you know, you might be dead before the next time we see each other, that's not kind, it's not useful, they don't want to hear that. But inwardly, just acknowledging that truth to myself, you know, it affects the kind of the quality of attention and the quality of care and the quality of love with which I, you know, say goodbye to them when I leave their home or whatever. So those are another few contemplative ways of just attending to endings. And then let's do one more. Oh, time races along. Actually, let's not. I was going to propose, but I'll just tell you it briefly and you can do it in your own time. Sometimes I do this with people as a dialogue exercise. You can also do it in written form. And you just complete the sentence without thinking a lot about it. You just complete it again and again and again and see what comes up. In order to die freely, dot, dot, dot. So in order to die freely, I need to whatever. Or in order to die freely, I would da, da, da. Or in order to die freely, I, whatever. And just see what comes up. What seems to be in the way of, if anything, of dying freely? And if nothing's in the way, you get the chance to actually taste the kind of confidence. There's a sort of deep, unshakable confidence in life that comes from when we really start to acknowledge nothing's in the way of me dying freely. So, friends, with not very much time remaining, I want to make chance a little opportunity for anything that might be standing out for you that you might want to give some air to by way of questions or explorations. So, Aggie, I think, has been tracking those questions. Do you want to... How do we do that, Aggie? Do you want to feed me questions or shall I just check them out myself or what?
Yeah, no, I'm happy to help you out with that. So there are particularly two areas of questions. So let's start with the highest rank question for now from Jess. How do we navigate suicide when accepting death of a loved one? So just in general, could you talk to, you know, suicide as a way of dying and how to accept it?
Yeah. Well, firstly, I think it's helpful to disregard all the various views about suicide, just like the various views about death, whether, you know, there's views, particularly in the various religious traditions about whether suicide is somehow morally right or wrong, or, and just to leave all of that aside. Essentially, in terms of navigating it oneself, it's loss and grief and love, just like if somebody's died in whatever circumstances, there's the loss of them, the love for them, the grief that is that, you know, love and loss, then there may be guilt. Oh, I could have done more, I should have done more, I could have said this or that, etc. And again, that's the same. All the same kind of feelings that can arise around people dying in other kinds of situations. The difference is that one knows that the person themselves, that in their moment of death was in some, you know, a lot of distress, probably. You know. They were probably, you know, and it does depend on the circumstances of the suicide, right? But probably they were in a fairly extreme sense of isolation, confusion, sadness, you know, hopelessness, and feeling so consumed by that or so isolated in that that the idea of reaching out to people who could be of support either didn't occur to them or didn't seem worthwhile or didn't seem possible. And that's just very painful to know that somebody one loves, that that's how their life ended, in the cloud of those difficult emotions. You know, so what do you do? Well, you take good care of your own heart. You know, it's painful. It's right in a way that it's painful to contemplate somebody else's suffering. No, that's the symptoms of a healthily functioning heart, an open heart, right? It's much more trouble if we're not painfully impacted by the distress of others, right? That's sociopathic. So the fact that you are painfully impacted, you know, it's good, but it's not pleasant, right? Like the Bhagavad Gita says, the good and the pleasant are not the same thing. So what does that mean, that it's good? It means, oh, you let yourself it's like letting the layers of it wash through. What are the layers of love and loss and regret and sadness or confusion, etc.? But how do you let the layers wash through? Don't worry so much about the story of what happened and why and what I could have done. Then you just get caught up in the drama of it. The drama isn't important. It's too late for what you could or should or might have done. Embodied connection, right? Let yourself feel, how is the grief or the loss or the hurt living in you? You let yourself feel the ache that's there in the chest. You let yourself feel the restlessness that arises as you don't know what to do with or with it all. And you care for that process. And that's the essence of a kind of real emotional digestion, is attending to the, you know, emotions have two parts. The cognitive part, the story of what happened and who did what and said what and da da da, and then the embodied part of how it actually feels as it moves through you. Much more efficient and effective way of digesting emotional life by attending to the embodied part. Because the story of it keeps reigniting and re-stimulating the emotion, but without resolving it.
Thank you so much, Martin. And maybe building on that as the last question, so what can be a good thing to say to someone who has lost a loved one?
I don't know. You know, I mean, I say that just because it depends so much on the circumstance of the loss, and it depends a lot as well on the capacity of the other person, you know. Like with long-time Buddhist practitioners and old monks, there's often, you know, we was very upfront about death. It's like you might say to someone, "Oh, you're getting old. You soon, you know, last few breaths. Soon, Lord Yama, who's the personification of death in the Buddhist tradition, like the Grim Reaper. Soon, Lord Yama will be coming to squeeze the last breath out of you." But, you know, a lot of people, they don't want to hear that, right? But I think what is important is to be real, emotionally real, and just acknowledge it, acknowledge love and loss. And that's one thing I think is helpful always, is to point to the fact that love is at the basis of the difficult emotions you're feeling are because of love. And if people can connect that when they're confused, when they're grieving, when they're full of, oh, I didn't do enough, I didn't say enough, letting them realize, oh, you loved this person. And your grief is the love for this person in the moment of loss. I think if you want one kind of blanket, always helpful thing, connect what's happening to love. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Martin. This was a beautiful closure to an amazing session. I'm personally really touched and really grateful for your gift of being here today, sharing your wisdom, and I'll be sure to use this session as an anchor to come back to later. I feel very much alive. Thank you so much.
Nice. Well, thank you, Aggie, for the support here, and to all of you for attending. I haven't been able to track all of the chat comments, but I've scanned some of them, and I've appreciated your comments, but also just the fact that you're here kind of leaning your heart in this direction. So nice to be with you all.
There's a lot of love coming into you, Martin. So later you can also review it on the portal. And for you guys, if you want to continue the discussion, you can always join our Facebook group, which is a private one for the Embodiment Conference, and share your thoughts. You can join the coffee breaks, again, other Zoom meetings on the portal where you can meet like-minded people. And of course, as always, a quick reminder, today still the full library can be purchased with 50% discount. So from tomorrow, it's going to cost twice as much as today. So if you'd like to purchase the full library and digest all of this wisdom, you know, at your own time, you can do that still today. Next up on this channel is a panel discussion, Monks and Scientists Discuss Meditation. That's another exciting one to look forward to. But now, coming back to you, Martin, with the last question. What is your top tip to stay embodied?
What's my top tip for being embodied? Well, let's just take one simple one. Slow down a little. Most of the time, if you notice, you're often moving at a speed that is a bit faster than necessary. You know, you go up the stairs and you can race up the stairs because mind's leaning out ahead of body. And just even kind of any time you remember, or you boil the kettle, you know, fast, even though it just takes the time it takes to boil, you know, you're making tea. It's like, and just whenever you remember, just a little bit, just slowing down the activity rate, slowing down the nervous system is a really great way, not just of feeling a bit more embodied, but of actually tasting a kind of a natural sense of embodied ease. So slow down a little bit. There you go.
Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you so much. Once again, lots of gratitude and love to all of you for being here with us, and to you specifically, Martin. I hope you will have a blissful day, and we will now end this session. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.